So Lars asked me to give a 10-minute overview on the Swarms survey, on which I also have a poster outside. Swarms stands for Sloan White Dwarf Radial Velocity Data Mining Survey. We found many more interesting and exciting acronyms. Unfortunately, they're not things you can really put on a slide or in a proposal title to us for federal funding. The idea is really very simple. All the Sloan spectra are taking in a minimum of three different exposures. This is done to reject cosmic rays, but depending on weather and what goes on in the particular night the spectra are taken, some objects have as many as 20 different exposures. And what we want to do is to use these different exposures to look for radial velocity shifts among the white dwarfs in the DR4 catalog. There's about 10,000 of them. The goal is to find the double degenerate progenitors of type 1a supernovae in particular, and just exciting systems in general. Unfortunately, I don't have to justify that from a scientific point of view, because we heard about them, these kind of systems, in the three nice talks before the coffee break. So I might as well just show you an example of what we're looking at. This is the first binary we found, SDSS1257. It's a pretty normal DA white dwarf, but if you look at the different exposures in the Sloan archive, you see that between exposure 0 and 1, which were taken on the night of October 3rd, 2003, and the third exposure, which was taken on the following night, just by sheer luck, there is a radial velocity shift of around 8 angstroms. Of course, this just signals that this might be a binary and an interesting system, but in order to get real information, you have to do follow-up observations with time-resolved spectroscopy, and we did that with the APO 3.5-meter telescope, which is just a few yards away from the Sloan telescope. And you see that even within the same night, you see the radial velocity shift there of the Balmer lines. And those are the points that we get in radial velocity, and that is the same sine curve plotted over a baseline of 9 days, and there's two sets of consecutive half-nights. That's the radial velocity curve folded in phase. Because we have a 9-day baseline, we can constrain the period pretty well. It has a 4.5-hour period, a semi-amplitude of 320 kilometers per second, and that alone is telling us that the system has to be either massive or tight or both. Of course, another of the goals of the follow-up observations is to take a good spectrum that you can do spectral analysis on, to get an idea of what the primary white dwarf mass is. And unfortunately, that did not work out so well. This white dwarf, if you plot in the log G versus effective temperature chi-squared space, has two minima. Hot solutions can be discarded by the Sloan photometry because they would have to be over here, and this is where the star is. Unfortunately, none of the cold solutions really give a good fit to the spectrum. That means that you cannot really constrain the mass in the usual way, which is by doing a chi-squared difference on the fit, because those chi-squared differences are not going to be significant. But you can draw. By the way, I should mention that this is a very common problem with white dwarfs that are around this temperature of 9,000 kelvins, and this is because the atmospheric models have problems around this temperature. So the actual mass of the white dwarf is not easy to determine accurately, but you can draw a very conservative estimate on its mass just by looking at the higher order Balmer lines. Even though, as I said, we cannot be very accurate, we can be very conservative and say that the white dwarf is probably massive, and the best fit mass is around 0.9, but it could be as low as 0.6. Even though this is the case, and it's an unfortunate circumstance, because the orbit has such a short period and such a high semi-amplitude, a large semi-amplitude, it turns out that the companion really has to be very massive. If you plot the mass function here, this is in cosine of the inclination, so this is 90 degrees, this is 60, this is 40. The minimum mass of the companion is around 1.6, and even taking the lower mass from a very conservative estimate, it really is only marginally consistent with being a very, very massive white dwarf. So this is probably a neutron star or black hole, which is pretty cool. I'd also have to mention that the The distance is pretty low. It's around 48 parsecs. So this could be the closest stellar remnant supernova explosion to the solar system. There's more details in that paper there if you're interested. This was just sheer luck, the fact that the two first exposures were taken in one night and the third exposure was taken the following night because of weather or whatever was going on then. But it need not be the case. This other white dwarf, for instance, these are three exposures taken in the usual way, consecutive 15-minute exposures. And you can see how the Balmer line centroids move. And even if you doubt this, because it's a kind of a noisy spectrum, then you look at the cross-correlation, you see very clearly that the cross-correlations between pairs of exposure shift. And we have seen this kind of thing even in pretty faint white dwarfs. This is almost 19th magnitude. And even if the spectrum is noisy and you don't see the radial velocity shift so clearly, the cross-correlation signal is pretty unambiguous. And of course, we did follow-up of these guys too, and they turn out to be the two detached double-degenerate white dwarfs with the shortest period known. 1436 is a little over an hour, and 1053 is a little under an hour. There's problems with the radial velocity curve fit for 1436. It doesn't look like a circular orbit does a very good job here. There's this systematic trend in the residuals. An eccentric orbit really does not improve things, and we really don't know what's going on, but the period is very robust. And for 1053, even though we only have 6 points, the period is also very robust. And this is a comparison of the plot that Heise already showed, where you see the double degenerate white dwarfs, combined mass is here, period in days is here. Systems to the left of this line will merge before a Hubble time. This is where our two objects sit. As all single-lined binaries, of course, the inclination is degenerate. So this is for 90 degrees, 60 degrees, and the tip of the arrow is at 40 degrees. It gives you an idea of what the uncertainties involved here are. This is the conclusions that I have for this. Swarms, I think, really complements and improves on the SPI survey very nicely. The wonderful thing about the SPI survey is because they were using high-resolution spectroscopy, they achieved a very, very nice 2 kilometer per second resolution in the radial velocity shifts. Of course, with the Sloan, which is only medium resolution spectroscopy, you cannot do as well, and it's only 120 kilometers per second or thereabouts if you use the cross correlations to support the selection. But the interesting objects are going to be the ones with higher radial velocities. Those are going to be the pre-mergers and the things that may lead to type 1 supernovae. So, of course, the good thing of going to low resolution is, of course, that we can look at much fainter objects because we don't have this restriction. And we have detected this kind of shifts in white dwarfs that are around a G magnitude of 19. So SPI is very good if what you want to do is do a systematic study of double degenerate white dwarfs and learn about populations and compare with the theoretical models that Heise showed. But swarms may be better positioned to find the premergers and supernova 1a progenitors. Of course, luck is involved, and we'll see about that. So that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, do we have any questions?
What are the options for the residuals on 1436?
We have tried several things. We have tried a standard eccentric orbit fitter, and the chi-squared really does not improve that much. The residuals go down somewhat, but at the level of statistical significance, it's not something you can put your finger on. The period is robust. There is definitely a 1.1 hour period here, but we really don't understand the systematics and the residuals here. Yes, it didn't work very well, but we didn't try all the possibilities. I mean, you can try a number of different things here. And we have tried a couple, it didn't work, but I'm not ready to claim that is not an option. It may very well explain the residuals.
Yeah, so these are faint stars for Sloan. I saw your spectrum was pretty noisy, but they're very bright stars for a telescope like Keck. And we can try and measure a gravitational redshift and constrain the mass better for the electron.
Yes. So Fergal Mullally, my co-I on this, is leading the paper on 1436 and 1053. So I'm not on top of things for those two objects. For 1257, we did look at this possibly what the gravitational redshift would be. And of course, you have to compare with the proper motion that's measured in Sloan. In that particular case, it seemed consistent with the kick you would get from a neutron star. So, but actually, the proper motion on the plane of the sky is pretty short. So everything would be more or less in the radial direction. Zero point of the radial velocity curve is blue shifted. So if you add to that the redshift you get from the gravity, you would get the 120 kilometers per second.
But if you know the radial velocity, you can use the offset from the gravitational redshift to get the mass.
Yeah. The problem is that we could not get the mass of the companion very accurately because of the problem that the wide dwarf atmosphere is cold. It would be very nice to have that independent estimate. But in order to do that, however, you also have to model the radius, the mass radius relationship, which is also model dependent. So.
I'm a little curious. You found this through a process that required taking a lot of data, going carefully through all of it. But can you estimate, you know, roughly how many other such systems might there be based on what you found and your efficiency within, say, a few hundred parsecs?
That's very tricky because this is a survey where we have absolutely no control over the original data. The original data are what they are. And we're pretty sure that anything that looks like this will pop out because it has a very clear cross-correlation signal. But I'm not really ready to make any claims about completeness or anything. Those are very tricky questions, and you have to think very carefully about what's going on. I should mention also that these two systems, after we had done the follow-up observations, they were singled out by this group in another paper that is not cited here, which is a mistake on my part, Aguirre et al. 2009, as possible candidates for binarity based on the fact that they're very low mass, both of them, around 0.2 solar masses. So the galaxy is not old enough for them to evolve as single stars.
Okay, we have time for a very short question, if anyone has one.
Which is, are there other cases where you've measured some velocity difference that you're going to be able to follow up?
Yes, we have lists of candidates. So this is basically limited by how much follow-up observations you can do.
Okay, if there are no other questions, let's have questions.
Good job.
Okay. And our final talk.